Welcome to the Andy Staples Show. We're going to do a little look back edition today because there's a story that came out on The Athletic by Seth Emerson that I think was just really good. And part of it is I've gotten a little tease into how it's come along and where it came from. But if you love college football and you watch this past college football season, you know there was a lot of doubt about whether it would happen. And Seth did a great job walking us through the weekend where it looked like it might not happen, where the Big Ten was on the verge of postponing its season, the Pac-12 was on the verge of postponing its season, the Mountain West postponed its season, the MAC postponed its season, and you know what was going on in the ACC and the SEC and the Big 12, and with a doctor who just happened to tweet something and didn't realize what he was getting himself into. But Seth Emerson is joining us today. Seth also covers Georgia for us, so we have some Bulldogs talk after this story as well because there's some stuff going on. But Seth, this story is unbelievable, and you and I talked about this before you started it. And I love the idea of walking us through the weekend where college football was on the brink. And so you went and talked to, I mean, everybody. You talked to Greg Sankey. You talked to Bob Bowlsby. You talked to Darian Rencher from Clemson, who was kind of the organizer of their player group. What was the mood like on that Saturday when I think the MAC canceled that day?
Well, slight correction. I didn't talk to Bowlsby or Swafford, who has since retired. But I talked to ADs in all conferences. Like John Curry at Wake Forest was a great resource because he's been in the Big 12 and the ACC.
And the SEC.
So and the SEC. And so there are so many people like that who have contacts all over. And so when we saw these reports coming out that Sunday that basically the season is doomed, that was a reaction to stuff that had been happening the previous two or three days where these guys are all talking to each other. And basically, let me go a little bit further back. I was asked by somebody today, like, what did I learn from doing this? And there was a lot of things I learned. Like, this was one of those where cutting room floor has so much good material and we could probably write a book just about those 3 days. Someday somebody needs to write a book about the whole saga of college football in 2020. But every Tuesday during 2020, and I think it's still going on, medical professionals from each of the Power Five conferences met and exchanged information. And they did that previous Tuesday night. And the medical representatives from the ACC, the SEC, and the Big 12 did not come away with any impression that the Pac-12 and the Big 10 were about to bail on the season. They thought they were all on the same page. It was
so this would have been like a full week before, because they did it on Tuesday of the following week.
Yeah. But that Sunday was the commissioner's teleconference when basically the Big Ten, Kevin Warren and Larry Scott said, we're going to cancel. Are you guys going to come with us? Greg Sankey, for his part in my story, says basically, I told them, no, we're 2 weeks away from that kind of a decision. And Bob Bowlsby and John Swafford essentially said, we'll get back to you. So the story of the next 72 hours, 48 hours maybe at that point, was the SEC kind of standing strong but helpless. As powerful a conference as it is, it was helpless because there was some thought, if everyone else bails, will the SEC just play its own season? So to that end, Greg Sankey told me he was talking to the commissioners of the American, of the Sun Belt, and Conference USA to basically say, look, if the ACC and the Big 12 also bail, will you go with us? Like, we can't do it completely alone. But they were also begging the ACC and the Big 12 to stay. By Monday, the ACC had basically reached a point of saying, we want to stay. We want to play. But if the Big 12 bails, then that's going to be really tough for us. So that it's set up, Tuesday night was the important night, and the Big 12 gets the intervention from this this cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic who is brought in to basically assuage the concerns of anybody remaining in the Big 12 and saves the day.
Well, and so you're talking about Michael Ackerman, and this is really interesting because he reads a Washington Post story over the weekend, and it's about a Red Sox player getting myocarditis, right? And
Eduardo Rodriguez.
This is the issue that everyone's worried about. This is the issue that the Big Ten is really on edge about. And Michael Ackerman's tweet, and it's crazy because it got 19 likes and 15 reads. Mm-hmm. So this is not something that went around the world.
As of now, like, you know, nine months later. So day of, it might have been like even fewer.
But he says, this is a great article. Mayo Clinic and Cleveland Clinic cardiologists are quoted. However, I've heard some using this article to call for the cancellation of all university sports this academic year. Nonsense, he says in all caps with an exclamation point. The data cited cannot compel that. And so what happens to Michael Ackerman and who calls him?
Nothing happens after that tweet. That's on Sunday afternoon. And on Tuesday morning, it was amazing, Andy, in retrospect, when I went back and researched this and looked at this, I forgot how much stuff happened. I didn't realize that at the same time Michael Ackerman is sending out this tweet, Sports Business Journal was publishing this interview with the ACC medical rep. And we can talk about that.
Oh, and yeah, and that was, that went but it, not well.
Yeah.
It did not go over
that
well.
That happened, but that all happened at the same time. Like, I didn't realize it was all happening basically at once. Michael Ackerman sends out another tweet on Tuesday morning as he's continuing to watch the college football drama. And this time it ricochets around the college football universe. I remember seeing it, and I saw some other sports writers retweeting it, and I retweeted it. I was like, this is interesting. Someone at Baylor, where they have through the medical fields, you know, Baylor has a pretty strong medical school. Someone knew Ackerman and called him and said, hey, you know, we're having a meeting tonight. So clearly the Big 12 was acting to do something there. And they sprung to action and they brought Michael Ackerman on that night. And he, like I said, he assuaged the concerns because I think if you talk to different people, like Shane Lyons at West Virginia told me, yeah, you know, it could have gone either way. And I think it might have gone the other way before that meeting, that Ackerman made a difference. Our colleague Jason Kersey talked to Joe Castiglione, who kind of had a different impression, kind of saying, well, you know, that meeting was regularly scheduled. Maybe it would have, maybe it wouldn't have, but
I know from somebody who was in that meeting, they told me they were getting a lot of texts from the ACC, yes, and the SEC, yeah, their colleagues.
Everyone knew that it was all on the Big 12 now. And the moment that the Big 12 announced or that word came out, it was Soonerscoop.com, an Oklahoma site report, was the first report that the Big 12 had decided to carry on. Then there was I don't even know if it was a sigh of relief, because in retrospect, we now realize that was the moment the college football season was saved.
But well, and it was also the moment they were going to have to do all the work to make it happen. So that was,
right,
you know, right, volunteering for some heavy lifting. And
then, yeah, the Big 12 came out that night and said, yeah, so we're going to let our teams continue practice and we're going to come out with a schedule, you know, but they didn't say there will definitely be a 2020 college football season. In retrospect, we now know that was the moment. Now, I don't know if we want to go on too much of a tangent here, Andy, but let's say it had gone the other way. ACC folds, SEC folds. Do we get to October and at some point everyone kind of get back together and say, actually, let's try? Maybe, but
I think
it would have been really hard to do that from go.
I think there's a chance of that because I kept asking people, why can't you do it in the spring? Why can't you do it in the spring? And the best explanation, nobody ever gave me a good explanation. The best one I ever saw was Jamie Pollard, the Iowa State AD, sent a note out to their fans saying, here's why it would be difficult. Basically,
yeah,
I'm going to have to lay everybody off right now if we are going to play in the spring, because there's no guarantee that it's going to be any better. And oh, by the way, it wasn't any better.
And it isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was, it's just crazy to think. And before we go any further, by the way, The Athletic is doing a deal right now where if you're not subscribing, You can subscribe for $1 a month for your first year. And you can read stories like this one we're talking about that Seth wrote, and also Seth's great coverage of Georgia, where, you know, George Pickens just tore his ACL. I write a little about college football as well. We have Bruce Feldman, Stuart Mandel, Nicole Auerbach, National Sports Writer of the Year. I mean, come on. Come on. $1 a month. It's like I used to go latte a month for the regular price, but it's like two lattes for the entire year now.
I wish we would stop.
We're crazy. Yeah. I feel like we have the inflatable waving hands guy, yeah, like at the used car dealership. Yeah. But no, this is one of those stories that you're only gonna get at The Athletic. We have the depth of team to be able to put out stuff like this, and we also are not making our writers crank out, you know, 500-300-word posts a day on nothing to make you click on them and then watch 18 pop-ups. That's not what we do. We say, Seth Emerson, please write this really good story, and we'll run it. And that's what happens. So, but let's get back to that weekend, because I thought you led it perfectly with Darian Wrencher from Clemson, where I had forgotten about the earthquake. There was an earthquake in the Carolinas that weekend.
I forgot about that too. I went through Darian Wrencher's old tweets from that period, and I didn't remember about the earthquake until I saw that he tweeted about feeling an earthquake that Sunday morning. And so I ran with it, used it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
I would argue, after reading your story, that one of the most important things that happened in all this period was Trevor Lawrence going to Darian Wrencher and saying, what are we going to do about this? Because according to Wrencher, Dabo Swinney had met with the team and said, look, I don't think this is going to happen. This doesn't look good. And remember, Dabo was the one saying, just be optimistic, months earlier. But he was, at that point, you know, he had enough information to say, I don't know what's going to happen. But then Trevor Lawrence goes to Darian Wrencher and says, what are we going to do about this? And how did that mushroom?
Well, it was a result of earlier in the summer, Wrencher, who had been very active in the social justice, racial justice initiatives arising from the George Floyd death, that Wrencher had built up a contact list, basically, of other college football players across the country.
Because he'd been Clemson's point person on that.
Right. Yeah. And so they had been pushing the racial justice initiatives all summer, and had, you know, also how that manifests itself for college football. And they now had this situation with their own season they were finding out was on the brink, and they decided to push it into that. But it ended up being so important that not only did they organize and, like, across the country get, you know, he pulled on this contact list he had of people on the West Coast and in between, like Trevor Lawrence, as I put in the story, called Justin Fields. And so they had people all over the country, and some good players, some just, you know, kind of players on the periphery, which I think Darian Wrencher will be the first to tell you that he is. He's a backup running back at Clemson. But not only did they organize to say, we want to play football, but they did it together with saying, we also want these rights. We also want, you know, I think on that list was, you know, the ability to transfer. They talked about the eligibility stuff. Some of this stuff was already smart.
This was a good time to ask for that stuff, because that moment showed how much they need the players. You know, you always had these hardos who would say, well, we don't need those. They can leave and we'll get other players or we'll. No, you won't. You've seen necessary roughness. You don't want that to be your school's team.
as I was writing this and as I was formulating my thoughts on all this, Andy, I centered on, I guess, my realization that there were two things that the SEC, the ACC, and the Big 12, the forces that wanted to play, were swimming upstream against in two PR fronts. One was the medical stuff, and myocarditis had emerged at that point as the big one. Michael Ackerman jumps in to help on that front, and Cameron Wolf at Duke kind of ambivalently, reluctantly jumps in for the ACC and sways ACC people there and helps on the PR front. But the other front was player rights and the idea that these unpaid laborers, and especially last summer with everything going on, these a lot of black players were being forced into playing against their will. Darian Rencher, Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields, all these players coming out and pushing the way they did countered that narrative. And on both fronts gave those three conferences, especially the ACC and the Big 12, enough cover to say we are not going to cancel yet.
Yeah. And Trevor Lawrence, I mean, he gets retweeted by the president when he sends his tweet out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but if Trevor Lawrence's tweets and then Justin Fields joined in, if they had just kind of stood on their own, that would have been one thing. But when they organized, when Darian Rencher organized them the way they did, that made it more than just a like sympathetic thing. It became a, this can be a tangible reason to play. And if we look back, Andy, if there had not been a college football season, I mean, where are we right now? I mean, the NCAA right now is reforming on name, image, likeness and a bunch of other stuff. If they had lost all this money last college football season, they might be able to say plead poverty and say, well, there's no money for anybody.
That's a good point. You know? And the player thing's interesting to me because what really made it hit home for me was Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields lending their name to it, because those were two guys who did not have to play. Like, Trevor Lawrence was going to be the number one pick in the draft no matter what. Justin Fields was probably going to be a top, you know, top five, top 10 pick in the draft no matter what. So they were going to get paid whether they played or not. That it meant so much to them to play. And, you know, Trevor's come out and said, well, I wanted to do it for Cornell Powell and guys like that who needed a good season so they can get paid.
And who's got to be drafted as a result of
it. Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's what really turn me on it, because I wasn't sure. I didn't want the players to feel like they were being forced into anything if they were going to play.
Right.
And as soon as they all said, hey, we do. And that's, we'd gotten that sense from talking to players and from talking to coaches, but that they came out so strong and said that, I think it made going forward with the season feel better.
Yeah. And it wasn't, look, there's no players union in college sports, and it's always going to be hard to get one because you have so much turnover.
As well, you also have a bunch of state universities and state, you know, labor laws govern how the people there operate. But you can, that doesn't mean you can't have a group that negotiates with the people in charge just because you don't have a union.
You could have a permanent group of professionals that organizes it year after year. And says, all right, you know, this group, now you get in and you're part of it. But this was an organized effort that sprang up that Sunday night while many people were sleeping to do this. And the fact that they were organizing to say we want to play was a huge PR win for those that wanted to play. And, you know, if you talk to some of the ADs I talked to, coaches, they'll tell you, well, we knew our players wanted to play. I mean, we were meeting with them constantly.
But they can't say that. They have a very huge financial stake in playing. So anything a coach says is going to be taken with a grain of salt. But when Justin Fields says it, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I believe that.
Yeah. And Trevor Lawrence wasn't just, you know, not to, you know, you use the phrase, lend your name to it. Well, they weren't just doing that. Like,
he was organizing. He was part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Darian Rencher wasn't just telling, hey, Trevor, you're a bigger name than me. Why don't you put this out? Darian told me that Trevor Lawrence went out to get dinner. And while he was out at dinner, I guess like waiting for the order or something, he sent out those tweets and he came back and Darian's like, Trevor, man,
Trevor Lawrence is waiting on chicken fingers, saving the football season. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. He's sitting, you know, I'm just imagining Trevor Lawrence waiting in his car for his chicken fingers to be ready on his phone.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is what was weighing on them. As Trevor Lawrence is out getting dinner, he's not thinking about, he's not thinking about the dinner order or what he's going to do that night. He's thinking about, I might not have a college football season to play, even though he doesn't need it. And so that shows you like how important this was to them.
So you even got Greg Sankey's blood pressure on one of those days. And 118 over 72. Those Iron Tribe workouts he's doing. Although gyms were closed, so he was just jogging every day, right? That was his burn off the stress move.
He was jogging every day. His doctor's appointment was scheduled for that Monday morning. You know, when I talked to Sankey, Sankey's done a lot of interviews, not necessarily on this, but just a lot in general. But I found him to be, I was surprised when I talked to him how like fired up he was about this.
This was personal for him, and it could have gone a very different way for him had he chosen wrong.
He remembered, he knew what I was calling about. He knew the story I was doing, so he had prepared a little bit probably in terms of getting his memory bank. But he wasn't the only one, Andy, that like when I contacted for this story and I was like, I want to talk about those 72 hours last August. They are pretty much to a man or woman. They all say, oh, yeah. I remember what I was doing. I remember that period. As a reporter, I remember what I was doing. That was when I thought that, I was worried for my job.
Yeah.
I was worried.
I was on vacation with my family. We were in a hotel and I worried about whether I'm going to have a job or not, but talking to ADs while my wife and kids are like, are we going to go get something? I'm like, no, you guys go ahead. I'm going to talk to these guys and see what's going on. And I remember talking to an AD about, same question I kept asking, why can't you do it in the spring? Why can't you push, 2 months? Why does it have to be decided right now?
That was the key thing that, especially when I talked to people in the Big 12, that they said, because the decision essentially came down to them, which is weird when you think about it. It came down to the Big 12, because you would think, Andy, culturally, and when you look at the mix of schools, that Big 12 has more football, quote unquote, schools. The ACC has the Tobacco Road, Virginia, Syracuse, Boston College. But a dynamic that I didn't know about, that I don't think I was able to get this in the story, but one of the reasons the ACC was sure that it wanted to play more so was that you had more of a mix of schools that absolutely needed that football revenue. Like Syracuse needed the football revenue more than Texas,
which is weird because we were assuming if you were in a state that was where the government handled this a certain way, that you were going to automatically. But Syracuse is the last one I'd expect that would need to play. But there you go.
Syracuse's president, I was told, was key behind the scenes and kind of not getting on a table and pounding for playing a football season. That was kind of Clemson's president, but Syracuse's president was in favor of, I think the correct point, the correct way to put it at this point is not cancel. Like absolutely play is different from not cancel. Syracuse's president was in favor of not canceling at this point and helped kind of corral people, maybe some schools that were reluctant. Whereas in the Big 12, you may have had like I said, Texas was not a huge force in the Big 12, unlike 10 years before during all the realignment drama, because Texas was in the middle of a transition in its presidency. And Texas, if there was no 2020 college football season, still has a couple $100 million in reserves to lean on. Whereas in the ACC, schools like Syracuse and Boston College and Wake Forest and NC State were really worried about what their bottom line was going to look like without a college football season.
And that makes a lot more sense. And I always thought the ACC, because I talked to Sankey a lot during all that and thought the SEC's move was, we're going to watch everybody, watch the NFL especially, kind of cheat off their paper and see what happens with them. But I always felt like if things turned, that Greg Sankey would say, you know what, I guess we can't do it. But the ACC always felt more gung-ho. And that what you just said explains why. Because of the leagues, so the day that the Big Ten and the Pac-12 decided to postpone, the league that was the strongest we are playing is the ACC. The SEC doesn't say anything definitive that day, And the Big 12 kind of, you know, tests the air and puts out what they put out. But it seemed like the ACC was always the most forceful about it.
And that was that Tuesday that the ACC put out that statement after, like, it was 3 o'clock.
Yeah, they were first of those three. That was right after the Pac-12.
Yeah. The Big 12 didn't put out anything because they hadn't decided yet. The SEC didn't put out anything because they were just waiting and they were hoping and they were trying not to be the bully and bully other people. If anything, Greg Sankey, like I said earlier, was corralling the smaller conferences, the Group of Five conferences, to come with him as kind of a show of, like, I think that helped too. I didn't play this up in the story, but when you have those three smaller conferences that also want to play, I think every time Mike Oresko spoke, I think it helped a little bit because it also battled the perception that it's just the big bad football schools,
right,
that, you know, want to have a season.
Right. And like you said, just the same Texas Syracuse comparison you were making, those schools in the American need to play more than,
yeah, even more.
More,
yeah,
than the SEC, and they were schools saying, do.
And we forget, Andy, what the debate was last August in terms of resources to test and how often a week can you test and all the other stuff. And those smaller conferences were getting out there saying, we can try to do that. We think we have the resources to do that, which quietly kind of nudges the bigger schools, the bigger conferences, into saying, all right, well, if Louisiana Lafayette says that they have enough to try and test, then you should too.
Yeah, then we can figure this out. And they did. There was a football season. One of the prettiest thing in the world, but they had a football season. And now, you know, I think everybody's not vaccinated yet. And I think, I would imagine most college players aren't, because in the States they're too young to meet the threshold right now, but they probably will be by the time preseason practice starts. And I'd imagine it's a pretty different world going into football season this year. So let's talk about that. Cause specifically the school you cover, Georgia, because they are in spring right now. And George Pickens, their best receiver, ACL tear. Do they feel like he's going to be out for the year?
Well, there's a couple questions here, Andy. One is the medical part of it. The normal ACL recovery tear is like, or period, is 6 to 9 months. Especially for this type of injury, I'm told it was a clean tear, nothing else involved. Georgia is really strong when it comes to rehab. They've done this before. Todd Gurley, Aaron Murray, they have a lot of experience with recovery. And 3 years ago, 2018, Georgia had a freshman cornerback named Devod Wilson tear his ACL in spring. He played in the Sugar Bowl.
Wow.
So if you're a Georgia fan, you're sitting there dreaming of get through the season, maybe even lose to Clemson in the opener, but then win your next 11, win the SEC championship. I'm obviously clearly easier said than done. But then you make the playoff, and here comes George Pickens to join your team in the semifinal game. That's possible. Here's the other part of it. Will George Pickens want to do that? Right. George Pickens is going to be in the 2022 NFL draft. It would behoove him at minimum to stay around Georgia and rehab, because those facilities are there. But does he want to go to class in the fall? Does he want to take, he probably has to take summer classes too. And he may not literally go to class. It's done online, but not that fun for a lot of people. Does he want to do everything it takes to still, frankly, be eligible for a Georgia hypothetical playoff run? That's the other part of it.
Well, and so Georgia should, for the season, have back Dominic Blaylock and Marcus, and is it Rosemi Jackson?
Rosemi Jackson.
My French accent's not
I'm
great.
Sure that I'm sure there's a great backstory to it, but man, is that a mouthful. And Marcus Rosemi was a lot easier. Yeah. Rosemi Jackson had the bad ankle injury in the Florida game last November. So, and Dominic Blaylock tore his ACL for a second time last preseason. So Blaylock should be back first, but it's his second one. So are you getting a dynamic, great receiver right away? Probably not, but Dominic Blaylock at 75, 80%. is still pretty good. Marcus Rosemi-Jackson would be really beneficial because he's a taller receiver in the mold of George Pickens. And they don't have that without George Pickens at this point. They have another guy named Justin Robinson who could maybe do it, but I think they've got a little, got to be a little more creative now with their receivers. I think they'd love to get find a way to get Eric Gilbert on their roster, which isn't going to be easy. But they do have Darnell Washington, the big tight end. They've still got a lot of weapons over there at receiver. James Cook will probably play, you know, more in the passing game now.
I was going to say, but they can use some of the backs because they're so deep in the backfield.
Right. Kendall Milton could too. But man, George Pickens, he was, you know, he was their best playmaker. You know, when you have him over there and the defense has to worry about him, they have to either put their best cornerback on him or two different people on him. That really opened up space for the other receivers.
This feels like a year that Georgia should be very excited. The quarterback thing's been a constant issue, but it felt like at the end of last year they had something with JT Daniels. Brock Vandegrift is now on campus. It feels like they should be expecting a lot out of this season because, you know, if Florida loses the two Kyles, you know, Kyle Pitts and Kyle Trask. Mm-hmm. Don't know if their defense is going to be better, although I think it probably will be a little bit better than it was last year. But the offense will look completely different. Florida plays LSU and Alabama. Georgia doesn't play either one of those teams. They have to play Auburn, obviously. But it feels like everything sort of sets up very nicely for Georgia this year.
It does. And they can lose that first game to Clemson, which I've said all along is a coin flip. I think the Pickens injury maybe makes it a little more tempting to pick Clemson in that game. But you said all along they could lose that game and they'll still be favored in the other 11, which – win those 11, hell, win 10 of them. And as long as they don't lose the wrong one, you could be 10-2 or 11-1 going into the SEC championship game and knowing when and you're in. But there's a lot that happens between now and then. I've said, Andy, all along that I thought that if this were anybody but Georgia, you would look at everything they have coming back and almost – no coaching turnover either. And you would say this is the SEC favorite. And this is a preseason number one or number two, that it was reservations because this is Georgia and you haven't seen them do it recently since 2017. The Pickens injury makes you think a little bit though. I want to give it a little time before I, you know, completely say they're not the SEC favorite anymore, but they are definitely still the SEC East favorite.
Yeah. And I think, This is the year that Kirby Smart can kind of quiet his doubters down. And I think there's a disconnect between the average fan and how the Georgia administration feels about Kirby. Because the idea with Kirby is, you know, he hasn't won a national title. He was brought there to win a national title. Now, he came very, very close in year two. But they felt far away last year. And I think that probably had a lot to do with them having to play a really good Florida. This was the best Florida team. Gosh, it was better than the 2012 Florida team that a really good Georgia team beat. That's probably the best Florida team since they played at Alabama for the SEC title in 2009. And so I don't know that they're going to be able to do that again. They don't have the constant talent level that Georgia does to keep reloading like that. So I think it bodes well for Georgia. And, you know, like I said, the administration at Georgia seems to me is very pleased with Kirby. They're getting what they want. They're in contention for the East every year. They've won it most of the years. But everybody wants the breakthrough. And this feels like if they're going to have the breakthrough, this is the year.
Well, I think what feeds the narrative on Kirby is overrated is that they've failed, I guess, spectacularly at the wrong times.
Right.
Like this
second
year
in 26.
They have a big lead on Alabama in the 2018 SEC championship and you have the fake punt fiasco. 2019, they're blown out by LSU, even though everyone else was blown out by LSU too. 2020, they weren't really actually technically blown out by Alabama. They were winning that game late in the third quarter, but when Alabama went ahead, they went far ahead.
Yeah,
they hit the afterburners. And then the Florida game, Florida won convincingly. So, look, they've ever since that 2017 run, they've gone slightly back every season. So they need to take a step back forward this year. At minimum, they need to get back to the SEC championship game, unless it's, you know, some freak of they go 11-1, lose to Florida, who, you know,
wins,
on some
wins
last
the SEC, field. Wins yeah. the national title. Yeah, that sort of thing.
You need, yeah, go back to the SEC championship game or backdoor into the playoff the way Alabama did in 2017. At minimum, you need to do that. But look, I think Kirby has set himself up some through no fault of his own. Some of it is the way he carries himself in press conferences that, you know, he doesn't engender as much sympathy as maybe a Dabo might.
And by as much, you know, he engenders no sympathy whatsoever.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I see different sides of him because I, you know, cover him every day. And, you know,
I don't think Dabo gets any sympathy anymore either, by the way. I think that right, those days are long gone.
Yeah. I mean, I cover and I see what I see here. But, you know, like, but on the other hand, like, I've had a commenter, and I know it's just one commenter, but for some reason it stuck with me. One time referred, or like earlier this year, referred to Kirby as Muschamp 2.0. I'm like, have you looked at their records?
No.
I mean,
No.
No.
Now, Muschamp 1.0 is helping out.
Yeah. I mean,
he's
exactly.
there. Now he's in the building.
There it is. Yeah. So, look, you know, Kirby doesn't need to like have a great year around here, but it would really certainly help the national narrative. And you know, but again, it all depends on how the season goes and how it, you know, we can't sit here, Andy, in late March, early April and say that if they have X record, then X,
right.
You know, you
right, because we don't know what's going to happen everywhere else. And I think that the SEC West is going to be an absolute bloodbath this year. I think there's
and Georgia doesn't have to face right. those teams except for Auburn.
Right. They don't have A&M. They don't have LSU. They don't have Alabama.
Yeah. Like our colleagues put out their coaching list. Stu and Bruce put out their best coaches list. And when Kirby was perceived to be a little lower, somebody wrote and said, well, you know, I'd be curious what they'd say if, you know, Kirby didn't have to beat Nick Saban every year. Basically, he's run into the Nick Saban freight train in 2017 and 2018.
Gus Malzahn has some thoughts on that.
Yeah. But Kirby also hasn't had to deal with the SEC West. Yeah. Like the SEC East this year is Florida and, you know, Missouri and Kentucky are plucky.
Yeah.
They're there. But
plucky
but
Kentucky, I like it.
At home.
When Ari is saying South that Carolina, Kentucky's the best job in the SEC, we're going to call them plucky Kentucky from now on.
And you can credit me, please. But then you've got South Carolina, Vanderbilt, and Tennessee, which we'll just charitably say they're going through coaching changes. But you know, but look at the resources
they're in transition,
the
Seth.
Too.
They're in transition.
Like, look at the if you added up how much each of the seven schools in each division spends on football, I think the SEC West would be, you know, just probably.
Yeah. Because Arkansas is spending the same as Alabama, and Arkansas wants to win just as bad. And I think the fact that you saw the improvement from Arkansas, you saw the improvement from Ole Miss, I guarantee you Mississippi State will be better than they were last year. It may not show on the record, but they won't have games where they're just non-competitive. And so you're right. The SEC West is going to be significantly tougher than the East, but and that works in Kirby's favor, and it just works against him if they can't get done what they're supposed to get done.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of what people don't realize, and it wasn't any of those other schools that got him so far. He's been the head coach 5 years. He's won the East three times. The two times he didn't, it was Florida. Mm-hmm. They've lost some games. They lost to South Carolina inexplicably in 2019. They lost to a bunch of teams 2016, but Florida is the one that they need to get over. And then Auburn every year too, but Auburn
they've done
in transition
pretty well against Auburn. Yeah. Georgia's been very good against Auburn.
He's lost to Auburn once and he avenged that game 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
3 weeks later.
Yeah. I was at both of them. And one was a beatdown and the other was also a beatdown in a completely different direction. So
yeah,
this is going to be a really interesting season in Athens. So I'm glad you are there and telling us what's going on. Again, if you want to read Seth on Georgia, if you want to read what I write, if you want to read all the excellent college football coverage in The Athletic or the excellent NBA coverage, NFL coverage, European soccer coverage, NHL coverage, NBA, I think I said NBA, Major League Baseball. It's all there. $1 a month. We're crazy. With these kind of deals, we're going to get fired. They don't do those commercials anymore, so I don't even remember how I'm supposed to do it. I just know I need the inflatable guy waving his arms.
I had people like say, like when they bring me off a radio interview, should we promo the $1 subscription thing? I've actually said no. I don't think
with deals like these, we've lost our minds.
Yeah, we already have over a million subscribers. Are we trying for 3 million?
We want the two. Well, there's 300 million people in America. I want 300 million subscribers. Okay. I want every 8-year-old.
There's a lot of stimulus checks going out. Let's get some of that.
Let's do it. Seth Everson, thank you so much. Appreciate it. We will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Andy.